Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress and writer Zoe Kazan. Early in our conversation, Zoe accused me of reading her journals. I'm sure that would have been a fascinating experience, but not one that you really need to understand her. Zoe's the kind of artist who turns herself inside out for our benefit as viewers and as humans. She's one of the most sensitive actors around, fiercely protecting the characters she plays in Olive Kittredge, Ruby Sparks, and her new film, The Big Sick. But she's less protective of her own ego in her deeply personal stage plays, and I truly admire that. To do the kind of work she does, you need both vulnerability and a really thick skin. She's still working on that last one. We talk about why she continues to chase the dragon of acting and what we can learn from Kids, Oscar Hammerstein, and Fiona Apple. She also shares what made her decide to talk about her struggles with depression and anorexia and why she works the hardest at the most painful part of her job. I must admit, our conversation left me a bit sad in places, but inspired in so many more. It also left me convinced that Zoe is an artist well worth following now and for many years to come. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on, not only because I think The Big Sick is a really great movie. We had Kumail on.
You did.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that, but because I am very impressed with the way you have created your voice in the work you do, and the fact that you are a writer, you're a playwright, you're an actor. And when I think about the work you've done in Olive Kittredge, in The Big Sick, and sadly, I have not seen your plays because I live in L.A. and I'm culturally less aware.
No one sees plays.
No one sees plays, but sometimes we read plays.
Oh, my God.
This is a play you wrote, and the only reason I bring it out is because I was fascinated by the dedication in it, and I thought it was a good place to start.
Oh, my God, I don't remember what it is.
Well, it's not so much a dedication, but you put two quotes in from people, and it just is a reason I like you so much, that you quoted Oscar Hammerstein and Fiona Apple. And the quote from Oscar Hammerstein is, "From all this evidence, could I not build up a strong case to prove why I am not happy at all? I could, but it would be a false picture, as false as if I were to describe a tree only as it looks in winter." And then Fiona comes in and says, "And I ran my hand over a strange inversion. As the darkness turned into the dawn, the child is gone." I feel like this may be a good way to frame your life.
Yeah.
And I wondered why you chose those quotes together. And I have my own theory, but tell me.
I think they were things that struck me as I was writing that felt like part of what I was trying to say or a bigger picture of it. The Oscar Hammerstein quote, it's a little bit about like how do we move on from trauma, and the seeds of it, I think, were in my own experience of my own depression, and I had an eating disorder in my teens, and I sort of like buried that in this book, but also about like recently I said to my therapist, I was like, does everyone find their family painful? Because I think I have a really happy family. I have a really close relationship with my parents and my sister, and I still find them painful. And she was like, yes, how could they not? How could a person not find their family painful? And I think that's sort of embedded in this play as well. It was my second play. And I think I was trying to write something. It's like entirely not autobiographical, but I think I was trying to write from a really personal place. So in that way, I think that quote speaks to a kind of thing that I feel in myself of feeling like my blacks are very black, but my highs are very high. And I think my capacity for joy is so great that if people meet me when I'm in one place, they would get a kind of impression about me that speaks to one thing, and then if someone saw me in a different light, I would be a completely different person, but it's the same tree, just without leaves or with leaves. And I also think it's sort of about choosing to see yourself not as defined by any one stage in your life.
Well, you mentioned family, and one of the painful things about family is sometimes they can only see you as one version, or the other version scares them so much that they try to steer you towards another version rather than seeing you as a whole person.
Does that happen to you?
I think it's in danger of happening to me as a parent, and I think it happened to me as a child.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably necessary for anyone to become a person, is to separate themselves from their family.
Right.
But as a parent, I think it's going to be very painful to separate that way and yet totally necessary. And I think that one of the through lines I see through the work, especially the work you've written, are those subtle dynamics of family which have great repercussions on personality and creativity. They're often so buried or so layered under, you know, that it's hard to get to. And I think this play is a good example of these layers of stuff that you can't even...
It's painful for me to read that play and my first play, which I wrote between the ages of 20 and 25, because I feel like there's so much of my... They feel like incredibly exposing to me.
Really?
Yes.
You know, it's funny you say that, because you're very open about, I mean, you've been open about depression, you've been open about anorexia. And I wonder, you know, when you say this play is exposing, I mean, do you feel more exposed as an artist through your work than your real life?
I guess there was a point in my life where I thought it would be better to be really closed off about those things because, it's more appealing or something to not think that a person in the public eye has, like, experienced trauma or problems or mental health issues.
You could present a picture.
Right, you could present a picture of yourself, exactly. But that's not my impulse as an artist. Like, the actors who I grew up, like, wanting to be, like, were, like, people like John Cazale. Like, I never wanted to be, like, a movie star, right? So then I was like, why am I doing this, and why am I trying to put a picture into the world that isn't actually truthful to me? And I especially, like, I wrote about my anorexia, like, just post the election, and I really felt like women have to stand up and be really strong right now. And part of that is saying, like, I'm not impervious. There are people out there that need to know that they're not alone.
Right.
And I really recovered, And I just wanted to talk about that within the stance of, like, having gone through something and come out the other side. So the exposure that I feel in my plays feels scary to me because it's not within my control. Like, I didn't mean to expose myself when I wrote these things. I just had an impulse to write the story, and then the more I worked on it, the more I think I buried of myself in it. And now when I read it, it's not just the emotions that I have buried in it and the life experience I have buried in it. It's also, like, the things that I didn't even know that I was putting in there, like my hubris or my ambition or my sentimentality. Or there are so many things that when I read them, I'm like, oh, wow, really, like, put yourself out there.
It's a funny thing to be any kind of artist, but I think an actor especially, you know, You have to have a direct route inside to the most vulnerable place, but you also have to have a really thick skin to be able to deal with...
Are you reading my journals?
Well, they sent them over. Your publicist sent your journals over.
Yeah, she went
under your bed.
Great.
No, but to me, that seems in some ways contradictory, that you have to have
it
a
is.
Pipeline. So how do you deal with that contradiction and then put on top of the fact that you're going to create your own material, you're going to write about it, so you have to step back and look at it from... one step removed.
I think that conundrum, truly, of, like, how do you protect your vulnerability that you need to do your job, but still have a thick enough skin to get through the craziness and the rejection and the public eye and all of these things. Like, I don't have a good answer for that, and that is the thing I talk most about with my girlfriends who are also actors. And I definitely err too far on the sensitive side. I'm a very sensitive person. I'm sensitive to other people's emotions. And, you know, I was like a freaky little kid with a lot of, like, weird ESP stuff. Like, I'm just, I'm sensitive. So the thick skin part is really hard for me.
Yeah.
And I have not figured it out. And I think that writing for me is another way of trying to like work through the excess I feel. That if I just had acting, not having a thick enough skin would be a much bigger problem for me.
Really?
Yeah, because I would have less to do with my time. I would need an outlet for my creativity that I wasn't getting. And the other half of that, which is really hard to talk about without sounding like you're spoiled, is that even if you're lucky enough to be a working actor, not all roles will engage your creativity. Some don't require that much of you, especially on film.
Right.
So you'll be waiting around forever to get a job and anxious about how am I going to pay rent or whatever. Then you get a job. And it's not like it only requires 3% of yourself. And you have to figure out a way to make that feed you enough to get to the next thing because you have to pay your rent.
Yeah. I would surmise from what I read about you that your work ethic is probably your savior from these other things that are harder for you in terms of the things you struggle with.
Right. I think it is. Writing to me feels like a direct antidote to the sort of morass of time that an actor can feel is empty and uncreative.
Can you write when you're feeling depressed?
No, but I have a really different experience of my depression than I did 10 years ago. I think with age, I've gotten much better at having patience with it and not trying to just like get past it or get through it. It is a more familiar companion. It is not as scary as it was when I was younger.
Yeah, those things are scarier when you're younger.
They're scarier when you're younger, and you don't.
You think you're not coming out of them.
Exactly.
You think this is it's exactly the tree in the winter.
Right, you think you're never going to come out of it.
Yes.
And then you do.
You think the leaves will never
actually
come again.
I have this memory of, so when I was, my depression and my anorexia were really linked. And the worst depression that I went through was when I was in the midst of my eating disorder. I was in college. And it was my first year of college, and I had never spent a winter on the East Coast before. Like, I had never come through winter. I grew up in Southern California.
Right.
Our seasons are really different. They're a lot milder. So I remember, like, the daffodils coming up outside my therapist's office in New Haven and being, like, so angry at them and feeling like, they're a lie. Like, they're a lie. Things don't get better. Like, the winter is still cold. These flowers have come up, and I'm still wearing my parka. things don't get better. The heat will never come back. Like, I can't feel my toes. I was so angry at these daffodils. And then the next year, I was in love for the first time, and I was doing much better. And I was, like, walking into my therapist's office and saw those same daffodils and was like, things bloom again. The truth of nature is all around me. Like, I am one with the universe, and we're all blooming, and I'm blooming, and, you know, it's the same daffodils. So,
yeah.
I don't know. So the other thing I was going to say is that Paul and I both work with this woman named Kim, who is, like, kind of a therapist for actors. She's an acting coach, but she's, like, a horse whisperer, but an actor whisperer.
Right.
And I was having this sort of, like, I was just having like this time in my life a couple years ago where I felt like when I was younger, I like took all the work that came to me because I felt like I was never going to work again. I was like always panicked about money. And I got to a certain point, like around 30, I was like, I need to be pickier. I need to not say yes to everything. I only want to do things that really are meaningful to me. And I'm going to try to say no more. And in doing that, suddenly it felt like there was no work. And I was really freaked out by it, and I was reading a ton. Like, I read a book a week that year. I felt like I was just, like, feeding myself, but I didn't really have a lot of access to my creative input. I didn't feel like I wanted to write. I mean, creative output. And I was talking to Kim in prep for a role at the time, and she was like, it sounds like you're really in touch with the feminine side of your creativity. Like, in a Jungian sense, the feminine side is all about feeding yourself, nourishing yourself, filling yourself up. And then the masculine side is all about output, action, getting things done. And an artist needs to have those two things in balance. And right now you've been doing a lot of work on your feminine side. And
you've been ingesting.
Exactly. And eventually you'll be ready to get back in touch with your masculine side of your creativity. And having that conversation, and I think in a way reframed for me what my periods of depression are now, which is that I do work really hard. I tend to burn my candle at both ends. And often the periods of depression I experience now are a little bit like crashes after a long period of work. Sort of like sometimes when you've been working really hard and you get sick afterwards, like your body had to hold out. And so I've been trying to think of them more as that, like as reset periods, like my body coming back to itself, allowing myself to just like nap and nurture and...
And not feel like I have to have the next thing, or if I say no to somebody, then I... I think that's such a common thing. If you say no, you're pushing away this work that's that so many people want, right? That's the hard thing. So many people would kill for the job you're saying no to, and so you feel like, am I being an idiot?
Right. I am very, like, I'm very generous when I read things. Like, when work comes to me, I'm often like, well, I could figure it out. I could make it work.
Right.
I could, maybe if I talk to them about the script a little bit, like I go into a place where I get like very like, I can fix it. I can make it work. And I think I stopped wanting to do that at a certain point. But I also feel, and maybe this goes to what we were talking about before we were on camera, like I think in the last 3 years in my 30s, I suddenly felt like my life had value outside of my work.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think
you didn't feel that way before.
I think it was really hard for me to feel like I had value outside of my accomplishments or outside of what, like, I was a...
Interesting.
I was, like, a really precocious kid. I was, like, an A student. I went to an Ivy League school. Like, I think there was something ingrained in me that
this
was,
This is
like,
how you people would perceive value in you is through the work you did, rather than just you being you.
Right, that. And also... Like, how can I be helpful to someone else? Like, a real pleaser.
you say that word like such disdain.
Well, you know, love to please teacher. So I think that, like, my sort of, like, workaholicness was, like, attached to that. Like, I want to leave something of meaning behind. I want to keep building my, like, quote-unquote career, and I don't know, in the last 3 years I was like, oh, like, I only get one life, and my experience of it really matters, and my happiness matters, and time with friends is as important as whatever. I don't know, I think that there's a false construct, an idea that you can leave like you're saying, like, you can leave a legacy behind of some kind, and freeing myself from that has allowed me to think a lot more about how I want to live my life.
I would think with a huge amount of I don't know, insight and intelligence into the world, there's a lot of melancholy and sadness that comes along with that.
Like that broadcast news scene?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. It's so funny you bring that up.
I really identified with that scene the first time I saw it. I was like, oh, God. Yeah, that character.
Do you think anyone knows
it? In broadcast news, Holly Hunter's character, who's very type A.
And very smart.
Very smart, very type A, in a period of time in her life when she's really having to concentrate on her career above all other things. Like, she has to schedule time for herself to cry every day.
Yes.
She is, like, handling an unexpected emergency, work-related emergency, and she's just stepped up and been a boss in a way that is really extraordinary, and her male boss, I think, in a kind of way to praise her but also shame her simultaneously, says it must be really nice to always feel like the smartest person in the room, and she almost cries and she says, no, it's terrible. She say it's terrible?
Yeah, I think she says it's awful.
It's awful. It's awful. That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely I'm not the smartest person in most rooms that I'm in, so I don't want to, I I don't want to misrepresent myself, but sometimes I have experienced my intelligence as a burden and as something that makes me lonely. And like in high school, I was so lonely. And my senior year, I was like, I'm done with being lonely. I'm really tired of it. And I decided that I would do an experiment where I stopped raising my hand in class, that I would only let myself raise my hand once in class. And everyone was much nicer to me. And like, I got a boyfriend. And I felt like, okay, this is it. This is like...
What did that teach you? That's so sad.
I thought, you know what? Honestly, the good thing is that I think it only taught me how to get through that year.
Right.
And then I went away to school and I met a lot more people who I felt in tune with. But it's sad about the world.
I mean, I think of that. Obviously, raising daughters, I think about, you know, I have one daughter who so doesn't want to grow up because she doesn't want to lose. She knows that people older than her don't believe that their stuffed animals have real lives or that, you know, and...
Your daughter and I have a lot in common.
Well, that's what I was sort of thinking. And you know, she's turning 10 in a week, and she's insisting that we say she's 9 and 12 twelfths because she doesn't want to be double digits. Because, and I think that there's
an inherent... I used to cry every year on my birthday.
You did?
Yeah, I didn't want to get older.
Okay, so what I take from that is that I hope she holds on to the inherent knowledge that being a child is the best thing in the world. I think she's smart enough to know that. Mm. And what she's afraid of losing is all the things that she never sees adults do that to her seem so intrinsic to joy.
Right, it's like that Picasso quote. Like, the rest of your life is spent trying to remember how to learn to draw like you did as a child, something like that, right?
And so I do wonder about that. If you sort of consciously tried to hold on to certain things, like, that's what makes me sad about, oh, I'll raise my hand less. And because what you're basically saying is, I'll be less enthusiastic about the material
right. And
why we're here in the first place.
Right.
And then people will relate to me more.
Mm. I don't know. I think... I feel younger now than I did 10 years ago.
What do you mean by that?
I feel like when I was in my teens and early 20s, I suddenly felt the burden of having to be an adult. And it was seemed like a scary thing and like an abstract idea that had to do with like responsibility and being tough and being independent and self-sufficient.
And as a woman, probably protective and... Like, I would think that at some point women realize they're prey.
Yes, I felt that. I felt that very young, though.
Yeah.
I think it happens really young.
Yeah.
Now
I'm even sadder.
Yeah. I remember being really little, like 2, and being on the bus with the woman who helped raise me. And a man kept winking at me on the bus. And I was like, he wanted something from me that was not right. And I remember the feeling that at 2. So it's really young.
Well, the navigation of that
alone
will wipe the child right out of you, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting because it's also, you're made to feel like that the shininess of yourself, like your beauty or your precocity or your intelligence or all the things that make you shiny are a liability, that they put a target on, your back. And so I do think that that's I think what I meant by toughness, that I felt like I had to roll with the punches and be like brassy and I don't know. I think I have a lot of ferocity in me, but I don't have a lot of toughness. And so it was really put on and I felt... Yeah, like I had to shed some of my child self in order to survive or make it or...
Yeah.
And now I feel like I have a lot more access to that again.
Thinking about the path to becoming an artist that can have enough of a point of view to create something that feels original, that path is fraught with so many lions, tigers, and bears.
You know?
It's just at every turn... There's something waiting to take that away and to fight through that. I mean, I guess wondering about that, do you think in your head from an early age. Do you think you were or are a writer first or an actor first?
Well, I think it's they're both related to an impulse towards storytelling, for sure, and loving to be told stories. My acting impulse and my writing impulse feel really separate to me.
They do.
Yeah, they do. I definitely wanted to be a writer from a very young age.
Before you thought of acting?
Definitely.
Okay.
I used to tell stories with my stickers and narrate them to my mom, like at 3 or whatever. You know, I always had that, and like writing books as soon as I could hold a crayon. And so I know that that impulse is very old. But my parents are both writers, and they're both tremendous introverts. And I am, I love being in my body, and I've always been very sensual and loved being with people, like real curiosity about people. I don't know if it's like those tests that you take online where you're like extrovert or introvert. I always
they're too reductive, right?
I know. I always test extrovert, but I think there's like a real introvert in me as well. But I feed off of other people's energies. I love being with people. I'm really happy in a collaboration, and like looking at two parents who are writers, like that's not a life that looked that appealing to me.
Oh,
like
right.
Being like alone in your room, like not having a lot of contact. I get like a real adrenaline high from talking to people and being with people, and it just seemed lonely and sad. So I auditioned for the school play when I was 14.
Okay.
And that was like a revelatory experience. I came home like all lit up and was like, this is what I want to do with my life. And then I think it took a really long time for me to feel like I could be someone who did a lot of things. I think it felt like, oh, now that I want to be an actor, like, I can't do my writing anymore. Like, I felt like a kind of responsibility to be the best I could be.
Right.
So I took a lot of acting classes and did all the school plays, and my parents were really insistent that I not work professionally until I finished college, so
what did they think of the idea of...
They were not happy.
They were not happy.
No. Would you be happy if your daughters wanted to be actresses?
You know what? I have to be honest with you. If it made them happy... Since doing this show, I have such a different respect for it.
Mm.
There is the version of they go get headshots and they start slogging around to commercial auditions and being
right.
judged for their looks and everything. That is a nightmare to me.
Yes.
But I also look at how acting is viewed in, say, London or in the UK, where it is an esteemed profession that it involves the study of literature and
right.
history, and it's a very well-respected career.
Mm.
And I hope that it would make me really happy that, and that they wanted it for the right reasons, you know?
Right.
But your parents being screenwriters that wrote for actors, it's surprising to me that they would be so against it.
I think they know it's a really hard life.
Right.
And frankly, I think they also felt like I was talented as a writer, and I think they
wanted to see that happen.
Yeah.
What message did that send you?
It just made me more stubborn about it.
It did.
Yeah,
note to self and to all parents out there, don't oppose anything vehemently because.
Yeah, I know. Like they were like, no motorcycles and no cigarettes, and I was like, you know, like
really?
Yeah, like anything they told me not to do, I was like, well, I'm going right for that then.
It should have been like no kale.
I know, they really should have.
And no yard work.
Exactly. No, I saved all of my money from like babysitting and being like, I was a camp counselor and paid for my own acting classes and took the bus before I could drive to acting class. You know, I was like bound and determined to show them that I was serious and that
wow.
I was, yeah.
What do you think they were most afraid of?
I think they were afraid of me being unhappy.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, my dad grew up around actors and, you know, because his dad is a director and was, and I don't think, and they had friends who were actors, and I don't think they felt like anybody was really happy, particularly actresses. And, yeah, I think they were worried. And, I would be if my child came home and said I want to be an actor. I think it would be like my worst nightmare.
Really? Is
I
it that?
I just think it's a really tough, horrible profession.
Yeah.
I really do.
Does it still feel that way to you?
Okay, so there's a difference between the work and the profession.
Right.
Right? The work is like, it's like chasing the dragon, right? Like, that first audition that I had like a transcendent experience. And my first, and I got a big role in that play, and doing that play was a transcendent experience. And sort of like the Picasso thing, then like for years, I became really self-conscious about my acting and the thing
trying
that
to recreate that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And like trying to get back there and developed all these bad habits. And then when I was in college again, I had like a, I did Uncle Vanya, I played Sonia, and I read Stella Adler's book on Chekhov, Ibsen, and Strindberg, and like it was like the veils fell from my eyes and like the top of my head like beamed out light, and I was like, oh yes, I know how to do this again. And then it was like breathing again, and like you're always chasing that feeling of like when the word and your impulse and your emotional life all connect up, and it's really like nothing else in the world. It's like your whole body is electric, and like you chase that, like that's, and I think it, I think that it's a beautiful, beautiful work to do, and I think that it's honorable, and that the impulse towards wanting to have an empathic connection with an audience through someone else's imagination is a beautiful thing. But I think that the profession is cruel, and particularly to women. I have friends of all statuses in the industry, and I don't see any rhyme or reason to why some people work and some people don't. I think we like to imagine that it's a meritocracy, and it's just not. I have friends.
Or that we have some control over it.
Right. Some of my most talented friends never get to work. And it gets harder as you get older, which is horrible. Like, DPs become, like, more venerated as they get older, and really that's how it should be with actors, too. And for some reason, we don't want to tell the stories of older people. And then also, again, with the, like, the vulnerability and the toughness, like, you are being judged on, like, your looks and your, like, sexual viability when that has no connection to the actual work. So, oh, and most actresses I know are miserable. So, or miserable with their careers. You're encouraged to feel like you're always on a treadmill trying to get somewhere that you'll never get. The most successful of my friends still feel like they're like climbing that mountain, and that's horrible. That's a horrible thing.
You know,
I wouldn't wish
once
that on
again,
anyone.
This is horribly sad. That
no,
that the very thing that can send creative shivers up your body, and that for you turned you on enough to change your entire path, right, and
right.
keep you chasing it,
right,
is also the thing that by very design is miserable.
Yeah, it's a very strange profession, and I feel like my like so I started writing again in a more serious way in college, and I had amazing writing teachers who gave me a lot of praise and encouragement. And it's really interesting. Like, my memory was that they gave me a lot less encouragement than they actually did. Like, I was cleaning out my childhood bedroom in the last couple of years and found all of these projects that I had done in college, you know, writing projects. And my notes from my teachers were so extraordinary, and I was like, oh, I remember getting these notes and thinking that they were giving me criticism, but actually this is all encouragement. So that says something about my brain.
It's the daffodils all over again.
Yes, exactly. But I think it's like it's also just what my brain does with praise, but that's okay. That's probably healthier. So when I was first out in the world and first started acting, I would have these like swaths of time between jobs, and I was so bored, and I had recovered from my eating disorder, and I was trying not to concentrate on my body. Like, I didn't want to become like my first agent. I was like, I will never lose weight for a role, and you can never tell me to. And she was like, okay. So I didn't want to work out all the time and become a person, like, I didn't want to re-engage that part of my brain. And so I was just drinking a lot and like sleeping with a lot of people. And I was like, this is no way for me to spend my life. This is not good for me. And I had started a play in college and was like, I'm going to finish that play. And I finished it, and that became my first produced play. And I really think it has saved my brain to have something that I can go to when the acting world feels cruel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the greatest lesson of all, is that you can go into a room, close the door, take out a pencil and a piece of paper, and change your, not only your career path, but you can change your outlook on life. You can change your interactions with people.
Right.
I mean, that to me is like the purest expression of creativity. Mm. But I guess maybe it's a totally different feeling than the chasing the dragon acting tingle.
It is. It's totally different.
Totally different.
Yeah, it is. Well, one is really physical and emotional and mysterious.
And acting is mysterious.
Yeah, I think so. There's something mysterious about it with like a capital M, like you're in touch with like the romantic sublime. There's something unknowable.
It seems to me like you're very self-aware, and that's probably your greatest weapon against all of the horrible things in this business. You know, because I think if you're not self-aware, then you're constantly being batted around by the winds of whoever, you know, is telling you something good or telling you something bad, right?
I think that when you're starting out, or at least when I was starting out, I think for some people probably everything works out really quickly. And I know from an outside perspective, it looks like I started working quickly and then haven't stopped working. But there are always, you never know what the future is. So there are always moments of feeling like, well, I haven't worked in 6 months and
right,
maybe this is the rest of my life. You know, especially because I did so much theater, like trying to figure out how to make enough money that I didn't have to do something else as well was like always on my mind at the beginning of my career. And I really feel like lucky that some of the auditions that I went on that were money jobs didn't work out.
Like, really?
Yeah, because at that point I would have taken anything. And like I remember auditioning for Gossip Girl and being like, it's not like I wanted it that much, but like definitely, if I had gotten that job, that would have been like huge, and I would have been so happy, and you know, I would have done that for 7 years or however
long. And people would have seen you as a totally
different
person.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's really hard as a young artist to say no to things, or even to know that you can, or I don't know. So there are so many things like that where I'm like, oh, that's the life not lived, and I wonder what my life would have been like and how people would have perceived me and how that would have made me perceive myself.
Someone in some audition room said, she's not quite a Gossip Girl.
Right. Thank God.
I mean, and I think that's right. I think that, you know, hopefully the goal in being yourself is that puts you on the right path.
Right. I guess it is. I guess you're sort of trusting in the universe to speak back to you as you speak to it. But I don't know how to say this without sounding disingenuous in some way, because obviously, like, I'm sitting here with you and we're promoting a movie that I hope does well commercially and everything, but I really don't feel a desire for external success in a way that would like make me famous or make me, I don't know how to say this right. It's like a cry into the universe. It's not about status or accolades or, and that is the thing inside of myself. Like if I woke up one day and felt like acting didn't make me happy and didn't give me that rush anymore, I would just stop and I would do something else. And I think it's the thing that makes me not precious about talking about my depression publicly or any of those other things, because I'm really aiming at something long term and ineffable. And I know it sounds disingenuous.
It doesn't sound disingenuous at all to me. I get the sense that I'm sitting across from a person who wants to make interesting, original art and wants to enjoy that experience doing it and have that experience fully. And all the rest of it has come along and attached to that impulse. And life goes on and intrudes, and we become adults and we deal with all sorts of compromises.
Right.
But if you don't hold on to the thing that makes you a person and makes you an artist, then what are you doing it all for? So it doesn't sound disingenuous to me at all.
You know, it's interesting. There's I think a lot about the concept of heaven. Like, why do we as humans, why did we create an idea of heaven?
Right.
Like, why is it in so many religions, an idea of Valhalla or an idea of heaven? And I think that there is something really human in the need to feel that there is a happy ending, that there is some happy forever or some happy reward for struggle. Because life is so hard for so many people, for everyone. And I think that an idea of fame or an idea of success is a little bit like an idea of heaven, that it's a way of delaying our happiness or thinking like, if I do X, Y, Z, the reward will come to me. And most people, when they get that reward, like whatever they've set up, it doesn't make them happy, and then they have to figure out how to make themselves happy. And I think, you know, like Carl Sagan has talked about, like the idea that you were born on a planet uniquely adapted to exactly your, to support exactly your life form. What more of a heaven could you need? And I feel that way a little bit now. I didn't used to. I used to feel really like there was always a carrot in front of me, and somewhere around my Saturn returns, I suddenly felt like, oh, like the work is the reward, and like there is no heaven in that way. Like there is no epic cosmic reward that will come to me if like I become more successful or more famous or, you know. And so I think that has reconstituted for me slightly what my aim is. And I think that that was also attached to me feeling like I need to get off the treadmill and not take every job that comes to me and not be working so much from a place of trying to make the universe give me what I think I deserve.
You know, anyone who says, well, there's got to be something better than this, like, well, come on, this is pretty great.
Right.
Let's just focus on what you have right here. Make this good.
Right, not destroy our planet.
Well, look, it's crazy how time flies with you talking about this. I'm fascinated talking to you. But I want to talk about The Big Sick, because the crazy thing about this film is Kumail Nanjiani made it. He wrote it with his wife, Emily Gordon. It's their story. He plays himself, and you get the sense that you are walking that line between a documentary or a docudrama and a narrative, and what I would think would be strange for you going in is that the real Emily's right there writing the script, and you have to come in and play her.
Right.
My question would be, how do you divorce yourself enough from the real her to be able to do the work you need to do to make the character real for yourself and still have that there? Was that hard?
I think it objectively sounds weird. Like, it's a weird situation to be in.
I mean, when you got that call or you got the script, that had to have been a thought. Like, this is sort of an odd situation, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay, so two-part answer to that question. I'll say the Kumail and Emily made it not weird.
Right.
And meeting Emily and feeling like an enormous kinship with her immediately felt like it made everything easier. Like, meeting her, I was like, oh, she's like someone I'd already be friends with. So that kind of cleared out the brush fire meeting her. I was like, oh, this is going to be fine. We're going to be fine. Kumail is like a real gentleman. And I think it was harder on him than it was on me. Like, when we first did, like, our, like, kissing scenes or whatever, he made Emily leave set And he was very self-conscious with me. And I had to be like, dude, it's okay. Like, this is not cheating. I know that this is a very weird job, but it's fine. And, like, there are no blurred lines here. Like,
right, but I understand where he comes from because he's playing himself
and recalling his actual courtship. Like, it's I think it was much more complicated for him than it was for me.
Right.
I will say that I think I suspect other female actresses feel this way too. Like, we're asked so often to play girlfriends and to play people whose function it is in the script to, like, be lovable or fall in love, that I think that I have in some way trained myself over the last 10 years of working to be a little chemistry machine, like to find ways of connecting immediately and listen carefully to the way that they carry themselves in the world and try to like seek out the person that you're playing opposite and try to get to their true self with how you approach them. And
So you were a little bit of a scientist.
I guess so. It sounds really perverse. It is a little bit perverse.
It is a bit perverse.
But yeah, I don't know.
No, but what a neat thing to be able to have the source material there.
Yes.
Right? But at the same time, did you have to kind of actively not make it an impression?
No. Honestly, okay, so I think underrepresented in my screen work that is more highly represented in my stage work is the desire to transform myself. I think on screen I've more often than not been asked to play a version of myself.
I think Olive Kittredge is an example of what you're talking about,
yes.
Though, where you transform yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is very much why I wanted to be an actor in the first place.
Is to transform yourself.
Yeah, to...
And that's how the business has let you down occasionally.
Yes, it has. That is the way. Because, like I said, like, the actors that I looked up to were people like John Cazale and, like, Jenna Rollins, like...
I was going to mention her.
Yeah, like it just hasn't been asked of me. And honestly, I don't think it's asked of that many women these days. Like, I think there's a real dearth of those kinds of roles for women. And that has to do with the kind of representation, the representation of what kind of woman is on screen. So I've found outlets to do that on stage. And when I first read the script, I was like, oh good, I can transform myself into whoever Emily is. Like, I'll meet that person, I'll study her, I'll like be like her. And then I met Emily and I was like, she's just like me. Like, we're so much alike. She showed up wearing a shirt that I...
Foiled again.
Not only own, but almost wore that same evening. I was like, okay, great. Like, our mannerisms are similar. I think our speech pattern is similar. Our minds, I think, work in a similar way. And I was like, this is not going to be what I thought it was going to be.
So credit the casting director.
So there you go. So instead I was like, how can I make this a challenge for myself? And... honestly, and this is going to sound really crazy, but I thought, like, I think this is an opportunity for me to be as relaxed as possible on screen. Like, I think I'm just not going to worry at all about trying to make anyone laugh, be appealing. Like, I'm going to treat this as if it is a Cassavetes movie, and I'm just going to try to be bring my most relaxed creative self to set every day. So I didn't do an enormous amount of preparation. I didn't try, like, sometimes I think doing preparation is like, can be like doing your homework, like, it makes you feel good, but it doesn't
yes.
actually do anything.
I understand that.
But that's it, and would just come really sort of like open and ready, and yeah, it was a good experiment. But I also felt like my voice was really included in the development process after I was cast.
I was going to ask you that, if you can turn off your writer brain when you get cast in a film, or if... you sort of get involved in
right.
in that.
I don't normally feel any involvement in the writing part of projects that I'm attached to, and I did not write on this at all, but I felt like my brain was really encouraged to be a part of the conversation, And like I said, we would do these long sort of like think tank brainstorming sessions. They were still working on the script up until when we shot. And, you know, there were things that I felt like, especially after spending time with Emily and getting to know a little bit about her, I felt like I have to stand up for her in this room. She wasn't always in the room with us because she had a day job writing on a TV show. So sometimes we would do these sessions without her, and I felt like I really had to represent her in the room. And I think it made me a little more forthright than I would have been otherwise.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, and it makes me think of Olive Kittredge and how it seemed like on that process you had to be really protective of that character too. Whether the person is real or made up.
Oh, she felt so real to me, Denise.
Isn't that funny?
You know, I had such a wonderful experience with that, but when I read the script, when the audition came to me, I was like, I have to do this. I felt like this. She was mine. Like, I was like, it's really funny because the thing that I felt more than anything was I have to play this so that I can protect Denise. I can't believe you picked up on that. I felt like I want to be her protector in the world. She needs so much protection, and I don't want someone to play her in a way that doesn't protect her. And like, I worked so hard on my audition for that and went in twice. And when they cast me, I felt like, I don't usually feel this way, but I felt like, well, they did the right thing. Like, I was like, this is right. And then I, like, every step of my I like completely reinvented how I worked for that, because I knew we would be shooting really quickly because we had such a small budget to shoot all those hours. So I plotted out my whole performance like I was working on a play. Like, I worked on it like that, so that when I would go to set, I knew, like, if I'm only going to have one take, this is how I'm going to do it. If I get two takes, I'm going to try it again this way, three takes this way. Like,
wow.
I had, like, a little plot, and it actually allowed me to be incredibly free with my collaborators, because I felt, like, very firmly in the driver's seat. And whenever I felt bad on set, so this is like so airy-fairy, but I would go over to my chair and I had a notebook and I'd write to Denise and say, like, how are you feeling? What do you need? How can I protect you? And then, like, I would like automatic write back. She would write back to me and be like, I'm feeling kind of like insecure and like my voice isn't being heard. And then I would say, well, do you need me to speak up for you? What do you want me to say? And I would like have this little dialogue with her. It sounds crazy. And then I would, and it allowed me to be selfish in my work because I was being selfish for her. Like, it allowed me to be like, if I really felt like she needed one more take, I'd be like, I need one more take, which was a really hard thing to say. And like a big HBO thing, and Fred Elmsworth is like our DP, and like, you know, you just like.
But Denise needed one more take.
But Denise needed one more take, and so it allowed me to do it. Yeah. Yeah. And it really did. I felt like, yeah.
I think that's fascinating, and it gives a little window into the work that no one ever sees, maybe not even the director ever sees. And when we see great performances, I think that that kind of relationship had to occur between the character and the actor.
Yes.
And, you know, it's no surprise to me that when I find out occasionally that the performances I'm drawn to had that sort of history and that sort of, like, vigilance, it kind of proves how subtle and nuanced this kind of work is when it's good.
Well, I think it really does speak to the thing that you started talking about earlier about your daughter, is that, like, a huge part of acting has to do with that play imagination, like the same thing that allowed you to play with your dolls when you were little or play house, like, that allowed you to believe, like, you hear little kids say, let's pretend, right? Like, let's pretend we're bunnies. Let's pretend that's a waterfall.
Yes, like, exactly.
Right. And I think for all of the technical stuff about acting and all the career machinations, like, at the end of the day, how deep you're willing to go into your imagination is, it's sort of like what they say about education. Like, when they're like, it doesn't matter what school you go to, what you put into your education is what you get out of it. I think acting is a little bit like that, which is like, if you are willing to invest fully. And I just want to track back, because I think some of the jobs that I took that felt less meaningful to me, the main reason I shouldn't have taken them is because they weren't that meaningful to me to start with. I mean, sometimes you have to take a job just because it's going to pay you. But if you don't have that impulse, you're probably in the wrong place. Like,
right.
Someone else should probably play that part who has that impulse towards it. And it'll be better for that film. And it'll, you know, I don't mean to slate some of the things I've done. I just think, like, I wasn't listening to myself about what my impulse towards the material was.
Well, and finding opportunity, that is the greatest challenge of an actor, is to find enough work to have those connections, right?
I think the toughest thing is how, well, and this is not new to the 21st century, and this is not exclusive to actors. It's for all artists, but like balancing what you do for money to keep your life going and protect your ability to say no to the, you know, sometimes you're making a decision that's purely based on your financial situation. And I think that we can feel shame about that, but there's no shame in it. And there's no shame in having a day job. And
right.
Like, I don't know.
It's notable that you at your level it can be saying that, and I think that that's actually inspiring to people who are coming up, that's experienced by everybody.
Right, like, we all have to make balances. You know, there have been jobs that I've taken that paid me well enough that I could then go do 3 off-Broadway plays and not work on a movie until the next thing that came along that
right.
made me happy. So it's all a balance. And I think most people, even people who make a ton more money than I do, would say that.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that to do what you do requires an incredible amount of, you know, setting yourself up for failure.
Yes.
Right? And to keep putting yourself back in that situation. Mm. The goal is always to find the one Olive Kittredge or the one, you know, Big Sick, where it all seems to make sense. Just like you said, there were 6 or 7 years between that first electric feeling and then another role that felt that way. But it's enough to keep you going. Like, I guess that's what great art is, right? It sustains us over long, fallow periods. And I think that that's what I admire about the artists that I follow, is that they don't take the easy route, and you haven't. And you've managed to create work that it really is your insides turned out for us to see.
Oh, that's very good.
And I'm impressed with everything you do. And
that's very nice. I got enormously lucky and to even be a working actor. And I also feel the enormous luck of having not gotten some of those jobs like Gossip Girl that seemed very shiny and appealing to me at 23 or 24. Like, I think when I look at other actors' careers, I think like, oh, they're so lucky, or they have some master plan, I take credit for having the desire to create a lot of different kinds of work, and no one's making me write, but the ways in which my like acting career have worked out for me to be able to do some work that I'm proud of is entirely in the hands of fate and fortune.
Right. Well, whatever the impulse is that's driving you, I'm happy is there. And
thank you.
And I'm very grateful that you came here and you were honest about it. And we had some pretty serious stuff. I feel like heaven, childhood, you know. But I think I'm impressed with you, and
thank
you for being so honest.
This was a beautiful interview. I'm so happy
I didn't
get to talk to you. I know. Well, maybe we will.
Well, listen, that was the rehearsal, so I think
great,
when we
perfect.
Do it with the
great,
cameras
great.
On.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And if you want to dive deeper into Zoe's career, start with The Big Sick and Ruby Sparks and Olive Kittredge. But then do what I did. Go on Amazon and buy copies of her plays. Both We Live Here and Absalom are available and make for some pretty interesting reading. I really enjoyed our conversation. It was food for thought being a dad and a reminder that we should not forget about the child that we once were or the childhood impulses that we once had. So thank you, Zoe, for a great conversation. And if you want to dive into more great conversations, I humbly suggest the offcamera.com website. We have over 100 episodes archived on the website, which you can consume in many different ways. If you haven't seen the show yet, do yourself a favor, go to offcamera.com and sign up for a monthly subscription to the TV show. It's only $4.99, and you can binge watch as many of our shows as you can handle, all for under $5 a month. It's a great deal, it's a great way to support the show, and it's a great way to do a deep dive into the processes of all these actors, artists, and musicians, and the occasional skateboarder and motocross racer. So check that out. And while you're there, go to the offcamera.com store. We make a magazine for every guest that comes on here. That's right. In 2017, we make a beautiful black and white print magazine. So do yourself and your coffee table a favor and get a 12-issue subscription to the Off Camera magazine. And to everyone that's listening and who has listened for a long time, I just want to say thank you. If you're loving the show and you just want to talk about it or give us suggestions or comments or criticisms, drop me a line. I'm sam@offcamera.com. You can also find us on social media. On Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, we are Off Camera Show. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. So check all of that out and be sure to join us next week when I sit down with actress and writer Michaela Watkins.
I definitely know rejection, but I have had so much of it that by the time I moved to LA, I had forgiven myself for all of the things that all my professors in theater school told me I was never going to succeed because of my voice, because of my posture, because of my body, because of, you know, I had just said, fuck it, I'm going to like run with it instead of try to look, sound, and act and talk like somebody else. You know, I'm going to embrace it.
The most important thing Michaela learned at classical music camp was that she was funny, which is probably why years of studying and performing classical theater left her hungry. Literally, she was starving. A road trip and an epiphany led to Los Angeles and the Groundlings. She never dreamed it would lead to Saturday Night Live or being inexplicably fired after one season. But Michaela told me she's grateful for all of it. She shares how sketch work made her one of the most in-demand supporting actors around, and what it is finally like to play a lead role on her Hulu series, Casual. She's honest about success, failure, and having to reevaluate her entire life in her late 30s. She's also very funny, except for the one joke she wishes she had never told. See you next time, off camera.